Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Smart Talk, we learn more about the Bras Across the Bridge Breast Cancer Awareness Event. But up front, Pennsylvania set up a tip line earlier this year for students to anonymously report threats in school. The Safe to Say Something tip line was created in part as a tool to stop school shootings before they occur. The first Safe to Say Something report came out earlier this week, and the results were a bit of a surprise. The biggest concern of students who contacted the tip line was bullying or cyberbullying. Nationally, an estimated 160,000 kids stay home from school every day to escape kids who bully them. At least one in three children experience bullying in school. The national online news site Patch has investigated and published stories about bullying as part of a year-long project. And here to learn about those findings, our guest today, Patch.com Deputy National Editor Beth Dalby. Ms. Dalby, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Maybe you have a story to tell. Were you bullied? Maybe you were a bully, or children, grandchildren, something like that. Maybe you have a story to tell, and you could give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Ms. Dalby, before we get started talking about bullying, tell me a little bit about Patch.
Well, Patch.com is a hyper-local news and community platform that has about 1,300 sites across the country. We have 125 or so editors who range in experience from college graduates to veteran prize-winning journalists with many years of experience. One thing that makes our platform unique is that we invite readers to post their own events, content, and really, in effect, talk over the backyard fence with each other. Just think of Patch.com as an online neighborhood.
So how did the project on bullying come about?
We had a manager's meeting a couple of years ago at our headquarters in New York, and we're brainstorming national reporting initiatives that could make a difference in people's lives. And each of our editors had reported stories after getting tips from parents whose kids had been bullied, and they didn't think the schools were doing much to help them. And a common theme in this was that these parents really didn't know where to turn. So we decided that because we're so heavily focused on community journalism at Patch.com, we should be a place where they could get answers about what really is a confounding national problem.
So the project began when, and it continues today, correct?
It began in 2018, and the response to it was so great that we just decided to continue it on.
When you say that the response was so great, response from who?
From readers. It's they've really been some of our most heavily read and commented on posts. And we created a special email, bullies@patch.com. And when we post stories in this series, we just get, many responses. We've probably gotten over 100 really solid emails that give us tips on stories and resources. This just really resonates with people.
So we kind of have established the background for the project. What were the broad takeaways from these stories over the past year or so?
One big one is that this really is nothing short of an epidemic. With, as you mentioned earlier, one in three kids is bullied. And if that ratio of kids came down with the disease, outrage would just be very widespread. And there would be a demand for a public health response. And, why shouldn't bullying be treated the same? We've talked to a lot of mental health experts and in bullying advocates and others who say it should be. It just changes who kids become.
The tip line that I mentioned in the introduction, one of its main purposes was to give students an avenue to report threats that they've heard that may prevent school shootings. Obviously, this week there has been a lot of attention on, not in schools, but some mass shootings. However, those threats were way down on the list, this report found. Bullying and cyberbullying were the number one threats that students felt in school. My guess is that you're not surprised by those results.
I am not surprised by that. Those results.
Why do you say that?
It's just because of the pervasiveness of the problem. I mean, one in three kids is bullied. And, you know, this just has cascading effects that, you know, their grades suffer. They're more at risk for depression. They're more likely to struggle with substance abuse and mental health problems that they can carry on into adulthood. Their relationships suffer. And, you know, in some cases, they kill themselves. And there are cases where they kill other kids. So, you know, we have to be really careful there because the research is still emerging on whether there are links between bullying and student suicide and bullying and school shootings.
So maybe we should provide a definition. In your reporting, what is bullying?
It can involve everything from being persistently targeted on the playground or in the hallways to isolating kids from friend groups to physical aggression to cyberbullying, which is, you know, really especially insidious bullying that takes place on social media apps or in text messages. It's kind of a cruel game of whack-a-mole. Once a post goes down, another one springs up, and, you know, we have the ability now to screenshot anything that's on the internet. And so even if a post is removed, what was said or shown can just live forever and haunt people the rest of their lives.
Well, you know, I do want to talk about cyberbullying and what's changed. But one of the things that I got out of, I want to say your research, but your reporting, is that there still are more kids who are bullied the old-fashioned way, meaning not online, but face-to-face in schools, than are bullied online, correct?
Correct. I think it's about one in four kids who are cyberbullying and one in three who are physically bullying.
And
but the number of kids who are cyberbullied is growing up. Growing according to, there was a new report that came out last month from the Department of Education's research arm, and it shows that girls are more likely, about three times more likely to be cyberbullied than boys.
Hmm. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. But, you know, I'm sure there are people who are listening and saying, well, bullying is a problem that has been around forever. Probably in the 1850s, in the one-room schoolhouse, there was a bully or two, you know, who was bullying other kids. What's different today?
What's different today is cyberbullying. Kids are on their devices 24/7. And, you know, back in when I was a kid, kids who were bullied could go home and get some respite and leave the bullies behind. They can't do that now.
And so what effect does that have? I mean, yeah, you a kid could go home. They may or may not tell their parents what's going on in school. But as you just described, now they go home, it follows them with them. It is there 24/7.
Right.
So, you know, what, I mean, does that have even more of a psychological impact?
It does, you know, because a lot of the times what our experts have told us is that, you know, these kids take their devices to bed with them, and so they're more isolated. They're alone in the room late at night. And they're reading, you know, these terrible things that are said about them online, or they're getting group text messages where they're being picked on and bullied. And so it just does have that cascading effect.
I'm curious as to what you found when a child is bullied online. Does that bullying continue in school and in person?
It can. It doesn't always, but I think that there is that tendency to exclude kids, to make them feel different, to put them on the outside of a group. And the other thing that's really different when it happens online is that in physical bullying, there might be a check on aggression when you look that person in the eye, but empathy just really fades to zero when it's online. Because you don't see the effect that it's having.
We're talking about bullying on today's program. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Check out some upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/Smart Talk. You can see some of the shows that we're working on, including tomorrow we'll be talking about student debt. Also, parole reform coming up next week. And we'll have Dr. G. Terry Madonna on next week as well, Monday, talking about the latest Franklin and Marshall College poll. Results are out today, but we'll get Dr. Madonna to analyze those. Those are all coming up in the next few days. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about bullying. Earlier this week, you may have heard the report that the very first safe to say something tip line report came out of the state attorney general's office. 23,000 responses, or I should say tips on that line. The number one threat that students across Pennsylvania found was bullying or cyberbullying. Our guest today, Patch.com Deputy National Editor Beth Dalby. Patch.com is a national online news site, hyper-local, reporting a lot of local stories, but has reported on bullying over the past year or so. If you have a question or comment, maybe a story to tell about bullying, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Facebook, you can leave a question or a comment. Also, on Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. That's 1-800-729-7532. Beth Dalby, we were talking a little bit about the cyberbullying, and that, you know, one of the things that's different is that when a student, a young person, goes home, they can't get away from it. The kids who are being bullied, and especially those who are being bullied online, do they tell their parents what's going on?
We have found that they do not. In some of these really extreme cases where kids have taken their own lives, the parents are just absolutely shocked to learn that this is going on. We wrote a story about a girl in Arizona who his behavior just suddenly changed, and her mother really tried to press her on it. And she just kept saying everything was okay. But, you know, mom knew it wasn't, that she was moody and her behavior had just suddenly changed. And it's kind of a neat story. What happened is that, you know, the mom pressed and, you know, eventually she got the girl to open up. And, in the end, they talked about how to resolve this, and the girl decided that she wanted to do a video that she called Where Are Your Words? And so she put post-it notes all over her T-shirt that listed every mean thing that had ever been said about her, and she posted it on social media. And so, of course, you know, that got picked up by everyone. And, you know, the bullies didn't apologize, but when Patch.com talked to her, what we learned was that they left her alone. So standing up for yourself can be very, very, it can lead to some change.
But you said that it is kind of unusual, though, for a child to tell their parent, but one of the things that I got out of your reporting is that when you talk to the experts, that one of the keys is for parents to try to reach their children when it comes to bullying, but to keep it simple. And, you know, by that, by saying, are there people being mean to you and that kind of thing. Talk a little bit about that, what you found.
Well, what we found, what we heard from most of our experts is that these conversations really have to start before kids go to school. And as you said, you do keep it simple. You may not talk to that five-year-old about bullying, but you can talk to that five-year-old about how we treat one another. And those conversations just need to continue, you know, right through high school graduation day.
Well, and that brings up a point as to the role of schools in this. Schools across the country, every school in this country probably has an anti-bullying policy. And we will talk about maybe even some state laws having to do with cyberbullying. But what role do the schools play in this?
Well, the kids are in schools, 8 hours a day? And so they are... The schools have some responsibility. When you talk to schools, they say, we can't do everything. And so there really is kind of a disconnect there. They say, parents need to be better parents and raise their kids. And one thing we found was, you mentioned the laws, and you're right, every state does have a law with a couple of exceptions. And that the legislatures pass these laws, but they don't give the schools the funding to implement the programs to hire counselors.
So it's
and so it's really, there's a catch-22 there in a lot of ways. And the other thing is that as bullying kind of moves from the classroom and the hallways to online platforms. I mean, that's really not the school's purview there. Mm. This happens out of their eyesight.
We had a listener who sent an email saying, the school is by definition a captive group brought together by law, an environment that brings the same persons together on a daily schedule. Why isn't conflict resolution a mandated class on a nationwide basis? This approach might be extended into the realm of school violence, including school shootings. What about that?
I think that's a great idea. And there are some programs. You know, there's a story we wrote in about a Texas teacher whose kindergartners start every day with a handshake and a hug. And those types of things seem to make a difference in how the kids behave in the classroom and toward each other.
Also, we hear that, and this is in an email, the Pennsylvania Council of Churches has put together a curriculum for youth on bullying. It can be used for Sunday school or in a retreat setting. It's available at pachurchesadvocacy.org, and click on the resources page. So there are resources out there. There are a lot of groups, a lot of people talking about this, but yet it continues. It's something that is so pervasive, as you said, to use your words, that it continues even though there are resources out there. How do we get people to use these resources?
You have to have the will to use them. It just comes down to seeing this as the problem that it is.
But I mean, is it the parents of the children who are being bullied, or I don't know, and I'm curious about who the bullies are, and if their parents are aware that their child is a bully, and what they do about it. There are several questions right there.
Well, our readers say that you don't, if you don't raise a mean kid without knowing it. If your kid's mean and inclined to bully people, parents know that.
Mm. By the way, what is Mallory's Law? We were talking about cyberbullying laws across the country. What is Mallory's Law?
Mallory's Law is a law that's moving through the State House in New Jersey, and it stems from the suicide of a 12-year-old girl, Mallory Grossman, and that is one of the cases that really opened our eyes to this problem. And it would hold schools much more accountable. And New Jersey has a pretty tough law.
Is New Jersey one of those states that other states should maybe emulate?
That's what the experts we talked to at the Cyberbullying Research Center in Florida suggested, that is a law that other states should emulate.
Mm. So, final question here, looking ahead and dealing with this issue that is so pervasive and across the country, what advice would you give parents of those who children have been bullied, the schools? I mean, I'm asking a broad question there.
Just talk to your kids, you know, without hovering over them and monitoring every step they take on social media. You know, just be involved in their lives. And the other thing that we can all do is just be better role models, because kids emulate the behavior that they see among their parents, adults that they trust, and even public figures. And we all just really need to start being nicer to one another.
Patch.com Deputy National Editor Beth Dalby. Patch is a national online news site. Ms. Dalby, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about, student debt. And we're going to have the president of Penn State University, Eric Barron, is going to be on the program, along with Ski, the president of Harrisburg Area Community College, and an expert who can provide some information on how to manage student debt. That is coming up on tomorrow's program. 5 years ago, the Feel Your Boobies Foundation came up with a unique idea to create maximum visual impact in their mission to promote breast health. The Bras Across the Bridge event in Harrisburg is a fundraiser to provide both college and minority outreach. The fifth annual event is this Saturday. Joining us is Lee Hurst, founder and executive director of the Feel Your Boobies Foundation. Lee, good to see you again.
Good morning. Nice to see you.
You're doing this a month or so early, aren't you?
Well, we normally do it in August. Last year, we did it in September, It is earlier than last year, but normally it is in August.
All right, so tell us about Bras Across the Bridge.
So Bras Across the Bridge is one of two events we run annually to raise funds to support our programming. This event takes place starting on City Island, and what we do is collect bras throughout the community in the month leading up to the event. And then we string those bras together into one long line, and people who register for the event are part of one big long bra chain that starts on City Island, parades over the bridge and into the city. It's a visual display of all of us being connected to a cause, and it's the major way we raise money to support what we do.
How do you raise money?
So people register for the event. You can register online at feelyourboobies.com. Click the link on the homepage, and online registration's open till midnight tonight. Otherwise, you can come event day and register as well. But each person that registers gets a fundraising page, and then they can share that fundraising page with family and friends to help raise money to support the event.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've talked on our program several times about the Feel Your Boobies Foundation, how it all came about. But you are really... One of the things you can say about Feel Your Boobies Foundation is you don't take the normal promotion avenue that many organizations do. I mean, this is a great visual, as you say, and it gets a lot of attention. And so what's your thinking behind Bras Across the Bridge?
Well, I think you hit it on the head, really. I mean, our overall approach tends to be a little bit more direct, and certainly the language we use gets your attention in a sort of a provocative way, because we try to reach the younger population, so we do it in a way that speaks their language. So a lot of times, the fundraising efforts that we take on and the social media campaigns we promote follow the same sensibility. So we want to do things that basically get out and get people's attention, to pay attention to the message we have, which is getting to know your body and feeling your boobies, because especially for the younger population, but for all women, if you know what your body feels like, it's more likely that you will detect a lump when it occurs. So for the younger population that's under mammogram age, trying to get their attention is important because that's the primary mission that we have.
Well, that's just it. And that's what I wanted to get into. Your target audience is who?
People who are pre-mammogram age. So the women who are under 40 who generally do not consider themselves at risk for breast cancer because, as you know, like me, I was diagnosed at a young age, didn't think about breast cancer. And so as my mind sort of processed all of that, I realized like maybe there's a way that we can get those women to pay attention because they're not being screened in any other way. And sometimes, you know, for me, I was seeing different doctors every year. So to completely rely on that annual exam for a doctor to find a lump, which was missed by my doctor, because they feel so many lumps and I didn't see the same doctor every year. So you really have to get to know what your body feels like so that when a change occurs, especially for a woman who's not being screened otherwise, more formally with a mammogram, that you can bring it to a doctor's attention as soon as possible.
You know, I think it's always wise when I have you on the program to have you tell your story because it can encourage other young women to get to know their bodies. Mm-hmm. So tell us your story of how you detected your breast cancer.
Yeah, so I think with my story, there's a couple key points. One is I wasn't doing a formal self-breast exam. So I was just getting dressed, taking a shower, noticed something that felt a little different, a little harder. So I was aware of it. The other thing is I didn't have a family history, which at the time I thought was a primary indicator of being at risk to get breast cancer. But in fact, it's not. 80% of women who get breast cancer do not have a family history. So while it is an important risk factor, it's certainly not something you should take a false sense of safety around. So for me personally, I was in my early 30s. I was a marathon runner, no family history. And I found a lump, went to the doctors like I would normally do, waited for them to do their exam of my breast, and they didn't notice anything. So then I would say, well, I feel this thing that feels a little different. And I'd have to put their hand directly on that spot till they would feel it. So they would say, oh, I don't think that's anything to worry about. And so the combination of them not feeling it and then saying that it's probably not anything to worry about, combined with not having a family history, all of that kind of pacified me for a little bit. Until it got to a point where it was on my mind too much. I just needed to follow up about it to make sure, you know, find out whether it was something or not. And it did turn out to be stage one cancer.
Well, when you say that you had to keep following up, but if the doctor said, oh, it's nothing to worry about, I mean, was it the same doctor you went back to and said, hey, I'm concerned about this, or was it another doctor or what?
No, it was a couple different doctors just because I was living in New York City. And so the practice that I went to had, you know, a lot of physicians. So it wasn't always the same person that I would visit. And I never went deliberately about the lump, but I did keep up with my annual exams and so forth. And so I felt like I was kind of doing my job in that manner. And then when they said it wasn't anything to worry about, I just sort of took their word for it until it became something that was on my mind too much. I just needed to follow up about it.
How big was this lump?
It was small. So stage one, I believe, is under 2 centimeters. So it was in that range, right on the border of stage one, stage two in terms of size.
But you noticed that it was something out of the ordinary for you.
Oh, I could definitely feel it. Yeah, it was like on the outer ridge, lower left side of my left breast, and it just felt harder. It was like it wasn't a cyst. It wasn't something you could move around. You might have a cyst in your body somewhere that you can kind of move with your fingers. It wasn't like that. It felt like it was connected to the breast tissue. It was hard. It did not get smaller. I can't say that it notably got any bigger in my case over the period of time until I did get it checked, but it didn't go away. And in my case, it didn't hurt. So I kind of, you know, I didn't know much about breast cancer. I didn't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing, but all of those things are pretty common in terms of a breast cancer lump.
So how did they find out? How did they test you to finally determine that it was breast cancer?
So once a doctor, it was actually a nurse practitioner here in Harrisburg, said, you know, I think you should just get that tested to know. And so the first step was to get a mammogram. The mammogram did show that it was a mass with some calcifications around it. So they ordered a biopsy, which came maybe 3 weeks later. After the biopsy, they took me straight to an ultrasound after the mammogram. So the ultrasound did confirm that it was a mass, not a cyst. And that's when the biopsy was scheduled. And so the biopsy really is the only way you can confirm that it's cancer because it extracts cells from the tumor. And those cells tell them whether it is a mass, just a general benign mass, or a cancerous lump, and mine was cancer.
And you were treated successfully?
I was. My surgery was a lumpectomy because it was small. I had no lymph node involvement, but I did do chemo because of being so young. So it was more of a preventative round of chemo, 4 rounds. And then I did 5 weeks of radiation and 5 years of tamoxifen.
You may have said this, but how old were you?
I was 33 when I got diagnosed.
33. Yeah. So you turned this into an organization reaching out to younger women because, as you said, many younger women don't think about this. This year, in particular, with Bras Across the Bridge, I see that one of the outreaches that you're really putting an emphasis on is reaching minority women. Mm-hmm. Why?
So to date, our programs have primarily worked through college campuses, through the College Outreach Program, where we provide free materials to college health centers and women's centers across the country. We do work with historically Black colleges and universities, but we've never really directly targeted the at-risk population, which are low-income, maybe underinsured women of color. And so African-American women in general are diagnosed at a younger age, and they have a higher mortality rate. And so what we decided to seek funding for this year was to test the materials we have to see if they're inclusive of that population. We know they work with colleges, but would they work if we put them in a health center like Hamilton Health Center?
In Harrisburg.
In Harrisburg here. And so the first step to launch this program was to test the materials, make any adaptations that are necessary. If the visuals don't work with that population, let's change them. If the language is not quite right for that population, let's change them. And so we're in the middle of doing that pilot testing with the materials, with the goal of making any adaptations, if any, to the materials, and then facilitating getting them out to federally qualified health centers across Pennsylvania initially.
Lee, I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and good luck with the event this weekend. Those listening, if they would like to participate in the Bras Across the Bridge, how can they do that?
So you can go online, feelyourboobies.com. You can click on our homepage. There's a graphic that says Bras Across the Bridge. Just go ahead and click it. It'll take you to the page where you can register. If you can't make it this weekend, you can go ahead and make a donation as well using the same link. And we'd love to have you online. Registration's open until midnight tonight. After that, you can show up on event day starting at 5 o'clock to register.
I stopped up at your office yesterday, and there are bras everywhere. Bras and patterns I didn't even realize existed, but...
Yes, we do get a lot.
Lee Hurst is the founder and president of the Feel Your Boobies Foundation, executive director, I should say, of Feel Your Boobies Foundation. Lee, thank you very much for being with us today.
Always thanks to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Joining us now is Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health Reporter. Brett, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Scott.
Let me just provide a little bit of background here. Kim Stringer, she's from Bucks County. She was a teenager. When she was a teenager, she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. She's now 27 years old. She sleeps in the shed and searches dumpsters for food. Her parents want her to be involuntarily committed so that she can be treated for mental illness. But Stringer doesn't want it and isn't required to get it. So, Brett, you profiled Kim Stringer. How'd this story come about?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, sometimes when you're doing these kinds of stories, it's really like trying to, wrestle a hurricane. It's just so chaotic, and the person's life is so chaotic, and everything the family's going through is so chaotic. So much so that the piece of text there that you read, which was the intro to my radio story, by the time we wrapped up that radio story, we had a very big surprise, which was that actually she was picked up by police and was in his. So right now, as we speak, Kim is on a 72-hour involuntary commitment, which was, as her mom puts it, they're just praying that leads to a good outcome at the end of that 72 hours, because at least they know she's safe for 72 hours. But let me jump back
to
the beginning.
Yeah, go ahead. Take a step back, yeah.
And tell you kind of how this came, because, Transforming Health and PA Post, we're doing a mental health story series called Through the Cracks, and Kim's mom reached out to me with an email, and it was a desperate and heartbreaking email to read. And I gave her a call, and as we do from time to time, you just assess whether there might be an opportunity to do a meaningful story. I went out and just sat down with her and her husband at their house in Bucks County in Yardley, and I didn't even know if I didn't know if I would end up talking to Kim. I didn't know if we'd if we'd be able to talk to her, if we'd find her, if she would want to talk, if she'd consent to it. But one thing led to another, and the next thing you know, I was actually profiling Kim.
But the reason, of course, that you wanted to talk with the family and talk with Kim was it was an example of involuntary commitment. Tell me a little bit about involuntary commitment, what it is, and what's the standard?
Involuntary commitment would be whenever somebody is deemed to be a threat to themselves or others. And so you, a family member, a friend, police, in this case, could petition to have that person committed to a hospital for, again, in this case, it's 72 hours. That could be someone who's suicidal or homicidal, potentially. And so that's the standard. And for people who are very acutely psychotic, it can be a way to kind of assess their situation and maybe get them into treatment. But for people who may have and really show clear symptoms of a profound or serious mental illness, but who aren't quite at that standard, and that was really Kim's case, and aren't quite at that standard, they really, if they refuse treatment, you can't force someone to get treatment. And there's a lot of history there, too, and you know, everything...
That's what I was going to bring. Can I interrupt for just 1 second?
Yeah.
There has been, over the decades, over the centuries, a lot of abuse.
Right.
Used to be that in this country, and even before this country was founded, that if someone was eccentric or just they weren't didn't appear to someone to be normal,
right,
that they would send them away and you would never hear from them again. Now, we've gone to the other side.
Right.
That for there was a reason that it was made more difficult to involuntarily commit someone, so those kind of abuses didn't occur.
Right. And that's why this is a fascinating topic, is because on one hand, you do have the desire to help people, but on the other hand, you have the desire, the idea that we have freedoms, and one of those freedoms is to basically live your life as you so choose, as long as you're not an imminent threat to yourself or others or breaking any laws. And you know, I approached it with a skeptical eye as well. So you know, okay, so she's dumpster diving. Okay, I knew people in college who did that. You know, okay, so she's pushing around a shopping cart. There are people in my Midtown Harrisburg neighborhood who push around shopping carts because they are collecting recycling because they make a little bit of money that way because they don't have jobs. So, you know, there you can look at any of these behaviors in isolation and go, well, so what? You know, but when you start to interact with, in this case, with Kim, you could really just see the disordered thinking. And listen, I'm not a psychologist or a professional in that way, but it becomes very clear that what's going on isn't what I described a minute ago.
Well, we have a couple of examples from your story where you are talking to Kim. If you would, set up this first one where she's talking about some paintings that she found.
Kim was going to study art. She is artistic, and she likes to paint and draw. And I saw a painting on her wall, and I just asked her about it, and she told me a little bit about it. So this will give you a great, great sense of Kim's voice and how she sounds.
Is this a painting of yours?
No, these actually, I found these in the dumpster. I found that in the trash, and I found that in the trash. And it was at my high school, local high school, Pensbury High School. I found this one in the trash, and I found this one in the trash as well.
I cannot believe you found that painting on the right, especially that one on the right is really.
I feel like they're both involved, and the lake in the background, and the trees.
Yeah,
you know, I liked the whole painting. I wish the person fit. Even the unfinished. I think the unfinished is still pretty great.
That sounds like anyone else you could talk to as we're sitting here or on the street in a restaurant, anywhere in public. Sounds like anyone else.
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, it's really this was very hard to. There was a lot of questions in the background. You know, I was having with my editors on this too because it's such sensitive subject matter. And you know, and Kim, when you talk to her there, it absolutely, you know, sounds like anyone. And who are we to say she needs this or that? You know, and that was, you know, fundamentally kind of Kim's point, was that she says she doesn't need treatment. The problem isn't her. The problem is technology and cars and her neighbor's TV's too loud, and that's why she's sleeping in a shed and going into the woods and everything. And so
now we have a second clip here where well, we'll just play it and then we can explain a little bit after that.
Okay.
I'll read books. Sometimes I'll read the dictionary. I'll read stuff based on like just words, just random words. I just read some words or just something. But I used to read books, but I'm actually writing my own life story. So I'm in the process of doing that.
So that's an example of what?
Kim's disordered thinking. And also, I'd asked her there, you know, what she's up to, what she's spending her days doing. And especially, I said, you know, when you're just hanging out in the shed, because, again, you know, she like lives in a small storage shed a lot of the time. So I think that's just an example of you know, her struggling to explain herself, you know. And I think it's sort of illustrative of her situation right now.
She refuses to go into treatment. Her family, her parents wanted her to go into treatment. Why does she refuse?
A lot of people do, and I think, you know, we can even step back from Kim a little bit so that I don't, you know, overstep, you know, what her particular intent is, and say that for people with a serious mental illness, whether it's schizophrenia or, well, even just schizophrenia, about 20% of people with schizoid type disorders have anosognosia, which is an inability to understand that there's anything wrong with them. And that's not just like denial. That's actually a disorder in your thinking where you're unable to process new information related to your disorder. So you don't understand why people think that there's something wrong with you. And so then oftentimes people will develop really kind of elaborate or sophisticated rationalizations as to what's going on, you know, which is often where it leads to blaming technology or TV or something or, you know, whatever. I think that that it, you know, Kim's case is very, very typical of that, where she basically says, you know, that it's her business if she wants to, you know, live the way she does.
You witnessed Kim. I don't know. It sounded to me, I was walking by your desk as you were putting the story together, and losing her temper. As it said, her mother said something to her, or said something to you.
Sure.
And I heard Kim say, "Mom, shut up."
Yeah.
And was raising her voice. Let me talk. That there are a lot of families that have those kind of conversations, unfortunately, but don't do it in front of a stranger, someone they don't know, especially someone who has a microphone in front of them. Mm-hmm. It almost sounded to me, and again, I am not obviously a professional, but an example of that schizophrenia or that bipolar episode that you were talking about, that you know, she was losing control of her emotions.
Sure. And that's part of what makes this kind of reporting challenging. You know, we talk a lot about reducing stigma around mental illness, which was something that is, I hear from state officials, I hear in doing these stories. But the thing is, it takes a lot of real vulnerability to be able to come forward and tell your story. If you've been diagnosed with a mental illness, as she has been, or if you're a family who's trying to get help for somebody who just basically says they don't want any treatment. And it's not, you know, it's not pretty. And it can really hear whether it's somebody having no control over their emotions, being on an emotional roller coaster ride, or whether it's the disordered thinking. You know, it's definitely something that's not if you've never experienced that in your life, then you almost just don't have a frame of reference for it.
Who is failing here? I mean, is the system failing Kim? Failing her family. I mean, her family obviously they're trying to get her better. They're trying to get her some treatment, and she refuses. Where do we, I don't want to say where do we point a finger, because you don't want to blame someone. You want to say, okay, what can we do to make this better?
One of the big things that just is so tragic when you see these stories is how, you know, the law is set up to prevent a person from being committed against their will. So that's where you're not able to get them, you know, the mental health treatment. But you know what ends up happening is that they just keep getting arrested, and they keep getting arrested for really like petty little things, or things that they might not have even had awareness over. Like in this case, like Kim has like some felony record for like receiving stolen property or something like that, or, you know, little things, harassment.
Well, that's
you
not
know,
a little
criminal
thing.
Right. No, you're right. It isn't. But it really speaks to the idea of a person's agency or free will. So again, she's, you know, getting into these interactions with the law. And so she spent 6 weeks in prison, after which her situation really deteriorated, at least according to her mom. And that's very typical, is that people with serious mental illnesses are not having interactions with the mental health system until after they've been in jail. And why should they be going to jail? You know, why is that the place where they're ending up? So, I mean, if you talk to her parents in this particular story, you know, they point their finger to a lot of different places, but certainly one of them was that even when she was first admitted to a hospital because of she was in crisis, suicidal thoughts and stuff, basically a couple years ago, basically she waited in the ER for 9 hours and then they left because nobody helped her. And it took them kind of, you know, calling the hospital CEO to get any response. And these are educated people with a lot of resources. And so you can imagine, too, how much harder it is for somebody who doesn't have those resources to help.
Well, getting back to what you were talking about with prison and jail, I mean, that's a story that we've talked about a mm-hmm. lot over the last couple of years. That, and we've actually had people who, you know, are in charge of running prisons and are in the criminal justice system say that our jails, in many cases, have been our de facto places for people with mental who are suffering from mental illness to be treated.
Yeah, it's a horrible idea, right?
And, it really is.
But unfortunately, they're the only ones stepping up to the plate. And, you know, we've taken people out of institutions and then created a new type of institution where you get convicted of a crime, and then you end up going to a special part of the prison, which is targeted for people with serious mental illnesses. Or maybe if you're lucky, you're in a county that has a diversion program, and then something else happens to you. But it is unfortunate that it seems the prison system and the legal system is where this interaction starts to happen.
A few months ago, Brett, you were on the program. We talked about Act 106. What is Act 106, and can you update us on it?
So that was that's a bit of a side note to this story, but it's a great example of one more thing that was set up that didn't really work out. And the irony is, it was really Bucks County Republican State Rep Tom Mert who led this Act 106, would change the standard for involuntary commitment in Pennsylvania so that there would be a different and lower standard for outpatient involuntary commitment. Basically, you wouldn't have to prove that someone was an imminent threat to themselves or others. You just have to prove that that person had a high likelihood of having harm come to them or an unsafe outcome, as well as you'd have to prove that they have a history of refusing or resisting any treatment for mental illness. So this was something that was set up. The counties all said, hey, this isn't going to work. There's no funding attached to it, and we can't actually really enforce it very well. But it was pushed through. It was signed by Governor Wolf. And here we are a few months later, and I did a survey of counties as part of this story, and nobody has implemented it because it's optional. So we have a new effort that was written in such a way that it basically has no teeth and nobody's doing it. And that would have been the kind of thing that maybe if there was more funding or resources tied to it or anybody actually trying to go out and do outreach, then maybe that would have been one more area where she could have gotten some help.
Well, counties absolutely abhor unfunded mandates. And if you make it optional and there's no money attached, of course they're not going to do anything with it.
And yeah, and you know, county mental health systems vary from county to county. The legacy there is that those counties exist as entities. They have those mental health and drug programs because of the legacy of us as a state decommissioning the institutions. So the counties have been given the charge of managing what had been those state institutions' purview. And the thing is, they have this big charge to handle this, but they don't get any more funding or resources. And, you know, even if you talk to someone like the Pennsylvania Mental Health Association, they say, you know, with someone like Kim, you could do more outreach and go out in the community and try to work with her and do voluntary stuff. You could have someone assigned to her, but that doesn't happen. because there's no money for it, and people need to be paid to do this kind of work.
Brett, to read the full story and hear the full story, Kim's full story, where can they do that? Where can our listeners do that?
Well, you should go on papost.org or WITF or transforminghealth.org. We have versions of the story on those three sites. They're all a little bit different, but I really just encourage people to listen to the radio story, the sound story that's embedded there.
Yeah, because this is one of those ones.
Yeah, it's you're putting you in someone's shoes.
Thank you very much to Brett Schultes. A lot to learn there, and I do encourage you to go to the website at transforminghealth.org to learn more. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we talk about college student debt. It is a real burden for many people across the state and across this country. It's coming up on tomorrow's show.